Welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later today will be Candace LaPage. And we're going to tackle another great movie review that may be overselling things, because I don't want to promise greatness. In advance of the review, though, we'll see how that comes out in the wash. Welcome to mid-September. It is technically September the 16th today, so congratulations, you have made it through the first half of September. And where we will be for the second half of September, who really knows? Because that's the way it's been these days. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new legacy sequel, Bill and Ted Face the Music. That will be in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to do something... Well, we've been doing, like, listen things since the pandemic began, as sort of there's been hardly any movie news because COVID shut everything down. So we're going to start a new kind of ongoing series here as we're going through the fall, called Run the Series. I definitely did not steal this from the AV Club, just saying. Anyway, Run the Series, we're going to take like a franchise and kind of run it down and rank all the entries, where it was strongest, where it was weakest. Because it's mid-September, and maybe some of us are starting to think about Halloween, but then again, maybe some of us were thinking about Halloween back in August. It's definitely top of mind now because everyone's wondering if there's going to be trick-or-treating or what's going to happen. So, in that spirit and everything... We are going to begin our Run the Series series with A Nightmare on Elm Street, which is the famous 80s slasher series featuring Freddy Krueger. So there were 9 entries in all, and I have included the remake and Freddy vs. Jason, which is technically, you know, a spin-off, not part of the canon series of those first 6 films. Of course, you also have New Nightmare in there, which is kind of like a reboot, a remake of that involved everybody who made the first one, but it kind of stands alone. So, 9 entries in all. We'll start at number 9. And for here, I put Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5, The Dream Child. This is the one that basically starts out like softcore pornography. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it becomes very much this. I feel like it's a very low point in the franchise. It just everything that's sort of come before, it throws it all together in this booyah base of rerun ideas. You know, it brings back the concept about the Freddy being the product of 1,000 maniacs who raped his nun mother. It brings in this idea about the Dream Child, which follows up on the Dream Master, which follows up on the Dream Warriors. It continues the story of Alice from Part 4, who is basically created because they couldn't bring one character back from Part 3. It's just the bottom of the barrel. It's just recycling everything, and this is like, I feel like Part 5 is where Freddy gets really obnoxious. You may think he gets a bit obnoxious before. I would understand if you say Part 4 he gets obnoxious, but I think in Part 5 is where it really starts to register that they have taken this character from being this kind of scary antagonist figure to like being the central clown of the franchise, and that's too bad. So rolling into that, number 8, I have Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4, The Dream Master, which is basically warmed over reruns of Part 3, because it features the surviving characters from Part 3 who are all killed off in like the first 10-15 minutes of this one, and then replaced with an entirely new group of young people, which is like par for the course in these films, but then, you know, it basically puts them through the same paces that the group does in part three, where they all basically have to team up in their dreams to slay Freddy. On top of this, you get the one character in from part three is replaced in part four with a different actress. Patricia Arquette played Kirsten in part three, but, you know, there's some debate about why she wasn't in part four, but from Patricia Arquette herself, it sounded like they wanted her to come back, and it just, you know, she was off doing other things, like new things, different things, and she probably would have liked to have come back, but the deadlines they were working with on part four just made that really impossible. So you get Tuesday night instead, and not that there's anything wrong with Tuesday night necessarily. It's just, you know, they bring her back to fill a spot and then kill her off so this other new character can also fill the spot of Kirsten with the same powers and all that. It's kind of pedantic. Also, who is the Dream Master? It's never decided. Is Alice the Dream Master? Is the Dream Master something else? Nobody knows, because they don't really answer the question. Okay, number seven is Freddy versus Jason. It is impossibly silly and campy, but I don't know how you make this movie otherwise. I mean, it's kind of a victim of all, like, the post-scream fervor. It comes from the director of The Bride of Chucky. It thinks it's smart because it's making fun of all the horror tropes from the previous Nightmare on Friday films, but, you know, the characters in the film are really, honestly, not that smart, and it's too winky and self-referential for my liking, although I think it's actually pretty well made, and if you enjoy it, you enjoy it, and that's fine. Number six is actually Nightmare on Elm Street Part 6, also known as Freddy's Dead. This is the one that kills, quote-unquote, killed off Freddy. I rank this fairly higher because it's at least trying different things from the previous two entries. Actually, the previous three entries, for that matter. You know, it has this interesting post-apocalyptic view of Springwood, Ohio, where, like, Freddy's killed all the kids, and you know, only the adults are left. And, you know, what kind of society is that? What does that look like? It's kind of harrowing. It's got an interesting take with Freddy having to try and hijack himself out of Springwood because he's killed all the kids. He lives in the nightmares of the kids, but with no kids, like, how does Freddy live? So he's trying to... It's interesting to think that a dream monster has a jurisdiction of sort of one small town in Ohio, but there you go. I think Freddy's Dead suffers because it has this bizarre 3D element, and also there's this stupid twist with the Lisa Zane character ending up being Freddy's daughter. Don't need that. I don't think Freddy Krueger needs a daughter, but I mean, A for effort in terms of trying new things. That brings us to number five, and I put here the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street. I think this is a case of parts being worth more than the sum of the whole. I really like Jackie Earl Haley as Freddy. He brings back, like, some genuine menace and creepiness to the character. It also helps that, you know, Jackie Earl Haley's bringing in this baggage. And it may be a sign of the times, but, you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street remake came out in 2010, which was just a few years after Jackie Earl Haley was Oscar-nominated for playing an accused child molester in Little Children. And so he brings that baggage in with him playing Freddy. And also it deals with the you know, what the other Nightmare films kind of tiptoe around, I guess, being from the 80s and it's still being rather taboo, this idea of the child offender. The remake kind of deals with that head on versus the way the previous movies kind of tiptoe around it. You know, Law and Order SVU kind of broke that taboo in a lot of ways by dealing with, you know, stories head on about children who are abused and the people who abuse them. So it gets a little bit darker in that way. Otherwise, it's a fairly routine nightmare film. It's too bad they decided not to make more with Jackie Earle as Freddy, because I really think he is a highlight. Number four is Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, The Dream Warriors. This is an intriguing entry because it brought back a lot of the people from Part 1. It brought back Wes Craven as a primary creative force. He didn't direct it, but he did produce it, and he was involved in the development of the script. It brings back Heather Langenkamp from Part 1, who played Nancy in Part 1. It gives her a role as kind of like a mentor of this new generation of young people who have issues primarily derived from Freddy taunting them in their dreams. It also brings back John Saxon as Nancy's father, and does, you know, interesting to tear apart how that relationship fell apart after Part 1, and how those characters redeem themselves. This is the one that introduced the mythology of Freddy's mother being a nun who was raped by 100 maniacs. It nicely sort of wraps things up. The series could have ended here, and I think that was probably Wes Craven's intent. It did not wrap up. It also, you know, the idea of the kids going into their dreams, teaming up, combining their dream powers to try and defeat Freddy. That's a lot of fun. That was a really great idea to play around with. Again, taken to, unfortunate levels of repeat in subsequent chapters. And it's also the kind of the last one where you feel like Freddy's an antagonist. I mean, I think Part 4 literally opens with Robert Englund in A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4, which, you know, just goes to show that that was the kind of point Freddy was the star. Until then, Freddy was kind of like the antagonist. And it's easy because Robert Englund has personality as Freddy Krueger, which is more than you could say, well, maybe that may be going too far. But, you know, the people behind the masks as Jason and Leatherface and Michael Myers, you know, they don't talk, so there's not, you know, you don't really see their faces, so there's not really a chance to develop a persona, per se. I mean, like, hardcore horror fans will tell you that the persona of Kane Hodder as Jason is different from other people who play Jason, but leaving that aside. Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge, is my number 3 pick. It has probably become reclaimed in the last several years, that people started to, you know, really analyze and dig and enjoy the sort of queer themes that were brought to this film, either accidentally or not accidentally, depending on who you talk to and who you believe. That subtext is really hard to unsee once you start to see it. It's also interesting to note that this is a rare slasher movie where there is not a final girl, but a final boy. And it's because of that, and because of the queer undertones that it brought to this, this like sticks out like a sore thumb. I think people have understandably and justly kind of reclaimed this as one of the stronger entries in the film, in this film series over the last few years, if not one of the stronger entries in the slasher subgenre from the 80s. And if you want to watch this or rewatch this, I would also suggest watching Scream Queens, or Scream Queen, I should say, which is about the making of Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, and some of the queer subtexts that are in it, or texts, if depending on who you talk to. New Nightmare is my number 2 pick. This is like Wes Craven being like super ahead of his time, being downright Kaufman-esque. As in Charlie Kaufman, you know, there are scenes in this movie. Again, it features everybody from the original Nightmare, except playing some version of themselves. So you have Robert Englund not only playing this, like, new, more ethereal version of Freddy Krueger, but also playing Robert Englund. You have Heather Langenkamp playing Heather Langenkamp. Even the producer, Robert Shea, plays a version of himself. So it's really, really meta. And they're like straight-up scenes of Heather Langenkamp reading a script in the film that is describing the scene that she is in at that moment. Really heady stuff. Really ahead of its time. Wes Craven was some kind of genius. And I don't think he gets nearly enough credit for that. And that finally brings us to, of course, part one, Nightmare on Elm Street. It was a very, you know, thinking back, it was a very different entry in the slasher subgenre, because going into dreams, it allows more sort of visualization, a bit more imagination, a bit more flair, and also it's a very small movie too, because it's like the main focus is like this four group of kids, so you get the chance to really know them, understand their dynamics, and Craven really takes his time as they go into nightmares and Freddy chases them and kills them. It's not like, you know, when you get to Nightmare 5, it's like kill, 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 kill. Oh, like every 10 minutes somebody has to die. Wes Craven has a little bit more restraint than that. And also it's notable for, you know, making Nancy, in that she's the final girl. She's not only the last survivor, but she's also extraordinarily proactive. She lays traps, she plans, she observes, she, you know, she thinks things through, she learns as she goes. And that's a really incredibly innovative change in the genre, where it's only like, it's usually like you're the last girl left alive, and that just involves running for 15 minutes from the bad guy until maybe you are saved by some outside force. Maybe a truck comes by and you're able to hop in the cab. Anyway, that is the first edition of Run the Series. If you're not sick of nostalgia yet, once you get a load of this week's review, we are going to review Bill and Ted Face the Music. After this music, you're listening to End Credits here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Out of
is he playing hopscotch by himself? Yeah. He looks miserable, dude.
Yes!
Dude, he's cheating.
Yes!
Let's go, dude.
Good luck, Dad. Be sweet.
Okay.
Hey, Dad.
If it isn't the Wild Stallions. Have you come to sue me again?
No, Death. Not at all.
We just need to talk to you, Death.
Talk to the head.
And that was a clip from Bill and Ted Face the Music. It's the new film from Dean Parisot, and it stars Keanu Reeves, Alex Winter, Christian Schaal, Samara Weaving, Bridget Lundy Payne, and William Sadler. So I am now being joined on the line by Candace LePage, or LePage. Oh God, I've already screwed it up. Anyway, how are you, Candace?
I'm good. I accept both pronunciations of my name, because I know not everybody is Canadian. Is not Canadian. Everyone here is Canadian. Not everybody is French Canadian.
No, what happened, see, is that I was looking at your name right at the top of the Skype box. As I was saying your name, I was like subconsciously reading it too, and so I was reading like all the syllables as they're properly anglicized, and
yeah.
And now we've squandered the first minute of this segment talking about that's life though. How are you?
I'm good. I am very excited. It's September. Very excited. It's cooling off and getting to fall season.
I concur. It's weird at night to have the silence of no fans going, but enjoyable just the same. It's kind of nice to not have to augment the coolness of the evening. So, yay about fall. And I know you were excited about this week's review, which is Bill and Ted Face the Music. So, I mean, obviously, let's start off with, you know, why you were excited about this movie, but also because you did your due diligence and did the deep dive by watching the initial two segments of the Bill and Ted Adventure. And I'm interested to know how the flow goes when you watch part one, part two, and then the 30-year stretch between part two and part three, and how it all jibes together.
Yeah. So you call it due diligence. I call it, just a really good excuse to watch at least one movie that was pretty formative and another movie that I enjoyed. I am 44 years old, which means that I was exactly the right age when the first Bill and Ted came out. I was, a tween girl, and there were two very cute boys on screen, funny, playing music and doing all the things that tween girls want to see on their TV screen. So the first movie, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, is... it's so deeply ingrained in me that I all of the cadence of every single line is just there. I can recite every single thing, and even in my sort of regular speech as I go around the world, I sometimes slip in, quotes from the movie, which sadly often go understood, unrecognized, so I might have to start using that as a measure to decide how much time I want to spend with people. So the watching the first one, which I did on Thursday night, was just a real luxury, a real pleasure. I pretended was for reasons, but it was really just because I wanted to watch something that was just so comforting. And I was also really excited to go back and watch the second one, because the second one, I didn't see as much. The first one is well known by most people, and the second one just didn't really have the same feel at the time. But a lot of people who, including like Alex Winter, for instance, who plays Bill S. Preston. he prefers the second one. And so I was really sort of looking forward to going back to it as more of an adult and to sort of see what it is about. Because it really is about something different than the first film. It's not really an excellent adventure. It's not an adventure through time in any way. It's, almost a philosophical sort of trip through hell and heaven and who you are and things like that. So I can understand why it didn't really go over as well. I think it was a little deeper than the audience was hoping for. And also a little darker too. It starts with Bill and Ted being killed by robot versions of themselves. So I think people were just, at the time, they were looking for something more lighthearted. And then, of course, I went right from Bogus Journey into Face the Music. And I see Face the Music as a blend of both of them. I do think there is actually some interesting sort of philosophical and social messages in this film, which they've managed to weave in while still having that more sort of fun comedy and obviously time travel of the first film. In a way, the only thing they really brought back from the second, which is quite possibly the best thing about the second film was the character of Death, played by Bill Sadler, who I also just love from my years of watching Roswell, but that's besides the point. But yeah, I think they sort of, you know, I don't think that the second film is not good. I think that it is good, and I think that a lot of people who watch it again now might go, oh, you know what, this isn't as bad as I thought it was, or it felt like it was. But I also think that everybody sort of learned their lesson about what people want out of Bill and Ted.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't remember the second one that well. Like, in the first Bill and Ted movie is the first movie I ever saw in the movie theater. So it's got that kind of special place for me. The second one, I mean, I probably watched it on video and kind of quickly, you know, archived it, you know, in the memory, like, well, that's, I watched that, and, you know, I didn't do what you did and revisited the whole thing, because I'm very much of an opinion that, like, these movies kind of have to stand on their own. And especially when you come to something like Bill and Ted Face the Music, which is part three, which, you know, like almost three decades after the previous entry, it's like, you know, people are going to be seeing Bill and Ted Face the Music that probably haven't seen either of the first two movies, because it's right there when you open up your Apple TV or your Cineplex app or whatever it is when you're looking for something to watch. So, you know, strictly from that point of view, it has to, I just feel like it has to stand on its own, which is where, like, these kind of nostalgia trips kind of usually trip up. It's like, it's so dependent on Easter eggs and the secret lines and the Dakota ring stuff that you kind of alluding to. I was pleasantly surprised that it didn't rely on that. This is kind of, there's a unique quality to the story. It's not quite part one. It's not quite part two. As you said, it kind of combines some of the ideals of both. It is a philosophical journey. At the same time, there is a lot of time travel. It repeats the thing from the first film where they travel through time and pick up various historical figures to do their history project. This time it's the daughters who are traveling through time to make the best band in the history of time. And then you do have this flip side of the things, where it is very much about two middle-aged men confronting the fact that they have not lived up to their perceived greatness, or the fact that they were destined to achieve greatness and they haven't lived up to that. And at the same time, it's all wrapped up in this very, like, upbeat and positive package. One of the things that strikes me is just, like, right off the bat, where it opens with this wedding of Missy to Ted's brother, and it is, like, the third member of this sort of, like, this extended family of the Logans and the Prestons, that this is the third marriage connection that Missy has made. And nobody here is angry. Nobody here is, like, misanthropic and jealous. It is just a really great occasion. And everyone seems maybe confused to be there, but nobody's outright angry to be there. And it's just, it's a tone that sustains throughout the movie. It's not that people, you know, there aren't, you know, aggrieved feelings or negativity. It's just that there's a really great feeling of positivity and working togetherness. And, like, even at Bill and Ted in their, like, most down moments, you know, managed to rally and find optimism again, which I found generally very life-affirming and pleasing. And it was a surprising but welcoming tone, given everything that's going on right now.
Yeah, I will agree 100% that as I was watching this, there were so many times that I thought, oh my gosh, this movie is so cheesy and you know, sort of dripping with sweetness, but oh my god, it still got me, though. You know, I still, you know, felt all the feels, as they say, at the end, even though it was a ridiculous ending that I'm not...
It was, yeah.
What I kind of like about the ending is, you know, everybody who knows Bill and Ted, of course, know the story that, you know, the future is this amazing place because they write this song that unites everyone. And in some ways, I can understand why in the second one, they didn't really sort of go back to that story, because how do you ever write the song that's going to unite everyone? Like, how do you get Bill and Ted to this place? Because it's never going to be as great as what, you know, they sort of set themselves up to fail in the film.
It's a MacGuffin.
Yeah. So, of course, this movie, they actually do get to that. And, again, like, it's just, it's cheesy and maudlin, and it works, which is so unexpected. One thing, you were talking about how, you know, that two middle-aged men, obviously, who sort of are, you know, they're not reaching their potential or what they're told they're supposed to be doing. And there are parts where they travel to the future, to future versions of them. Mm-hmm. And certainly the first two times is, you know, they're kind of at some lows, and they're not necessarily treating each other very well. But then they get to this third future version of them where they're both in prison, which is bizarre. The whole thing is sort of silly. But what's striking is that even at that point, those two future Bill and Teds, who are angry at themselves, angry at their past selves, you know, kind of want, like, this is all wrong and it's all got to be fixed, still stand up for themselves, the other versions of themselves. You know, they there's a danger there of someone, you know, killing them, and they still defend themselves. And I think it's really interesting to see, you know, this is part of where we get into some of that sort of philosophical thing of, like, who are you? Who are you meant to be? Who are you always? You know, when they go all the way to the future of the two of them, again, still together because they're so codependent. You know, as they're old men, and the younger versions speak to themselves, the older versions, saying all these, like, you know, I'm sorry I never got to know you better, says old Ted to young Ted. And it's just so, like, whoa. Like, not to coin a phrase. Oh, that's a really good point, right? Like, we don't spend enough time getting to know ourselves. And it's just, they, not only do Bill and Ted have a really beautiful friendship with each other, they also sort of have a beautiful friendship with other versions of themselves, which I think is, again, it's one of those really sort of warm, life-affirming things. Reminds us that, you know, we should get a chance to talk so kindly to ourselves. And it's Bill and Ted. How do they do this?
Yeah, it's a reminder that this is, like the characters... I think people want to read them as, like, simplistic, as, like, surfer doofus guys, but, you know, there's so much more deeper stuff going on, and it's a bit reflective in sort of, like, the Keanu Reeves personality, where it's, like, frequently duplicated, or frequently imitated, never really duplicated, that, you know, Keanu Reeves in real life being this, like, very laid-back, soft-spoken, yet, you know, somehow very deep guy, even though it's behind this persona that was very much informed by Bill and Ted, or even he's not even playing Ted. You know, you think about Point Break, you know, the superficial commonalities between, you know, the character of Ted and the character, Johnny Utah is his character in Point Blank, if I remember correctly.
One of the best names of all time.
Yeah, so, it's, you know, there's a very particular part of that, you know, goes into, just simply showing that these guys are not doofuses, they're not dumb, they're kind of, like, just operating on an entirely different wavelength. And yeah, it's codependency for sure, But is that necessarily a bad thing? That, you know, no matter what, you know, going through your life, you have this person who's sort of like by your side, and no matter what, and, you know, it's interesting to me that going through those futures where they're trying to, you know, outwit their younger selves, and, you know, they, one of the futures, as you said, they end up going to prison. At the end, they are still in what I assume is some sort of old folks home or hospice, you know, in, you know, they're still in the same hospital room together until the very end, that there's never any internal blame for their struggles. It, you know, whether something good happens to them, whether something bad happens to them, they remain a unit that supports one another through good and bad. And it's simple to, it's implicit to just sort of write that off as just, you know, the central gag of the film, and not try to read anything sort of deeper into that. And I think that's what the script and what the movie is trying to remind us in those scenes, that it's not, this isn't a gag. This is kind of like an ideal way of living, sort of, you know. We should have a Bill or a Ted in our own lives who is as supportive through thick and thin as Bill has Ted and Ted has Bill. Even if it does annoy their wives occasionally, too.
Yeah, though, you know, we haven't really talked much about their daughters, mm-hmm. but, you know, I do love the thing, and it is, even with their wives, right, there's a little bit of marital strife there, but, you know, in the end, their wives do care about them and support them, and their daughters are just like 100% behind them. You know, the entire arc of the daughters' stories is that they're trying to help their fathers. They just have so much faith mm-hmm. in, you know, these two men, which is, you know, kind of refreshing. They don't really give an age, and I think we can't really base it on how long since the last film, because right. The babies were born at the very end of the second film. You know, I think we're meant to believe they're probably about the same age that Bill and Ted were when they originally went on their excellent adventure, which was, you know, at the end of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really an age usually where kids are, you know, that supportive of their parents. You know, you'd think, especially because at this point, Bill and Ted and their band Wild Stallions has gone through some pretty low lows. you know, you'd think that the kids, the daughters, would be embarrassed by them at this point. But that was never, ever, ever part of the story. They were always like so supportive, and I especially loved too when they did meet up with Death again, and again the daughters were just like building him up, right? and doing it in an honest way, because they did sort of say, well, yeah, you know, this record, yeah, it wasn't really that good, however these parts here were so good.
And it's, you know, it plays into their role in creating the song that unites the world, that it's not so much them creating something out of whole cloth, it's them bringing the different elements together and using the strengths of the different performers. You know, their kind of role as, they're not musicians themselves, they are sort of like music appreciators, you know, they're sort of like, I don't know if Pitchfork Music is still around, but it, you know, but you know, they're kind of that sort of oeuvre where, you know, they're not quite like the record store pricks in High Fidelity, but you know, they're very sort of into music and again, you know, bringing that positivity forward and helping people recognize their strengths while also recognizing their weaknesses, but saying, you know what, that's okay. Here's where you're really strong. Don't do this other thing. Do this thing instead. And I do love the daughter characters a lot, and it would have been so easy to cast them as like the opposite. Like it would have been such like a like ridiculous kind of lazy thing that's like, oh, they're MBAs or something, you know, they're interested in, you know, profit or whatever, you know, kind of representing the opposite of what the Wild Stallions are meant to achieve. It that would have been an incredibly lazy route to take the film, and it was such an interesting, it's so much more interesting that the basically the story leads up to, they are under the impression they are helping their fathers achieve their dream, but in the end it turns out the fathers are helping them to achieve the dream and to make something memorable. You know, it's a nice symbiotic sort of parental relationship that's built up, and again, it would have been lazy to make an antagonistic. It's so much harder, but also so much more fulfilling to make this a positive relationship where the two children are helping the two fathers, and the two fathers help the two children, and more about building something up as opposed to tearing something down first and then trying to make something of the mess. It's a much harder trick that the screenwriters and Dean Pariseau pull off by, you know, making them a multi-generational unit as opposed to and making another source of antagonism.
Mm-hmm. And let me just say on the music side, so obviously in 1988, you know, sort of heavy metal, guitar metal was kind of the music of the time. So that was what Wild Stallions played. And, you know, we're led to believe that the song they were going to create or the music they were going to create was this sort of guitar heavy music. And then here in this one, you know, the two daughters talk about how they're just appreciators. They just listen to stuff and kind of play around. But the reality is that they are creating music. And I like the fact that they did, because they both have mixers there and they're sort of composing this different group, saying, you play this line, you play this line, you play that line. And then they're, you know, doing different mixes. And I love that they, you know, and a film that's clearly made by all the same people who made this film in 1988, who were probably into, you know, guitar heavy rock in the 80s, and then when the second one came out, you know, Primus was in the show. Mm-hmm. So they were still, and Death is a big bass player, which is so bass was a real big thing in the second film. And yet, even though it's all the same old white men who grew up listening to that kind of music, they're still able to make a movie now and say, what you're doing here with mixing different sounds is still music. It's still art. Unlike many old white people I know who grew up in the 70s and 80s who were like, that's not even music. You're just hitting buttons on a keyboard. It's like,
right.
It is still music. Just because, you know, one person isn't plucking every string to play a chord doesn't mean that they're not taking the sound of a chord and mixing it with the sound of a drum and making music. So get over yourself. And I think it was great that, you know, without even really pointedly sort of doing it, they really did talk about, you know, the two daughters saying, well, we don't, you know, we just listen to things and then we mess around. And Bill saying, yeah, maybe you listen to stuff and you mess around and that's good. That's good enough. It's good enough to save the world.
Right, and there's kind of a commentary there about, you know, sort of the cultural imperialism of, you know, putting one type of music over, you know, other types of music. That's not what it's about. It's about taking a little something from everybody, and that's throughout the film. It you know, I guess maybe it was a bit of foreshadowing when you go back in time and Jimi Hendrix is jamming with Mozart and you know, they're both playing off each other and I mean probably not terribly historically accurate if you were to drop Jimi Hendrix in like 17th century Vienna,
that's probably not the reaction you would get, but it is the, in keeping with the vibe of the movie, that music is kind of a universal language no matter where you come from, no matter what type you play, and that everybody can jam together, which is, of course, you know, the how the everything leads up to in the end is just basically everyone jamming across time and space. And
and all they needed was the beats per minute and the what key it was in.
Right.
And then just play your own thing in that key at that beat, and you are playing the same song. And then again, we get to this, you know, massive social message. this film, holy, was so... it's like it was made by a bunch of communists. I can't wait for the people on the right to complain that Bill and Ted are trying to feed our kids, you know, lefty communist Marxism.
I'm not sure that they ever weren't. You know, it's...
I mean, I don't disagree with you, but there's always people who seem to read different things into what they watched as a kid.
Well, this is true. I think that, you know, you look at the original, and we haven't mentioned him yet, but, you know, George Carlin, who was the Rufus in the first two films, are kind of, you know, a mentor from the future who helps them, you know, pass their various tasks. You know, George Carlin was hardly... an intellectual pacifist, let's say. He was very much, you know, on the side of you know, sort of just being like this agitating force. And then he comes into Bill and Ted and greetings, my excellent friends. And there's a really couple of nice touching tributes to him in Face the Music too. It's interesting to, you know, to sort of try and apply sort of the modern culture wars onto this, because, you know, at the heart of Bill and Ted is always that, whether the song was like heavy metal or grunge or whatever the song ended up being, it led to this utopia where everyone was most excellent to each other, and it there's always kind of this borderline cultish vibe to the future that the Wild Stallions create. But I think that this film does a really great job of sort of, you know, massaging it into, it's not just sort of a gitch or a gimmick or anything like that. It's something that's real and can be achievable if we just sort of take time to listen to each other and allow ourselves to play off each other. You know, approaching everybody with, you know, positivity and optimism, and, you know, not screaming and yelling at each other, which, you know, it's... I think this film was always going to be over the heads of some people.
which says a lot.
Yeah.
Says a lot. I do love the bit of the Terminator pull in this film.
Yeah.
So it was just sort of a nice little extra bit. And then again, you know, just sort of shows what you just said, right? Approaching everybody from optimism, because even when faced with this Terminator, you know, Bill and Ted were kind to him, and you know, made sort of like rational arguments to him for what he should do or shouldn't do.
Yeah, they didn't blow. I mean, the robot has kind of or the Terminator, I should say, has kind of like an existential crisis, but you know, it's never like a fight. And what I find fascinating, that, you know, even hell is a pretty chill place. They all end up in hell, and they're walking around and they're trying to find death, and they, you know, they are talking to a couple of demons, and the demons are being very helpful, and you know, they see the robot in hell. It's like, oh, there's a robot in hell. Well, now you see something new. And it's just, you know, even in hell, there's you know, just great people. So it I'm not sure what's going on there, but there you have it.
Yep. That's just Bill and Ted, I guess.
Oh, and I do want...
Be excellent to each other.
Exactly. And I do want to highlight having Kid Cudi as a quantum physics technical advisor for the group. That was a nice touch.
Yeah, it was great. Especially because the question of how time travel works has always been very unclear in these films and does not matter. Like, it obviously does not matter. And so in this film, they sort of, like, amped that up. It's like, nope, it makes no sense and it doesn't matter. And here we've put this character in here to tell you about how much it doesn't matter.
The character, of course, being Kid Cudi playing the Stephen Hawking version of himself, which I enjoyed. I also want to just highlight, too, Keanu Reeves is a great actor. The fact that he's able to, you know, for the last few years, he's sort of been on this kick of, like, just the very high intensity of the John Wick films. And to be able to shave off that goatee and unslick his hair and to, you know, go back into the mold of Ted again and find that character and find that that center again. Never tell me Keanu Reeves isn't a great actor.
Yeah, I've been a Keanu Reeves apologist for as long as he's been acting, pretty much. You know, there were maybe roles that weren't great for him, or particular accents he was asked to put on, which were just like, just go without the accent, it'll be better.
I know exactly what film you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, I never found him to be a poor actor. And on top of that, I also found him to have more charisma in, like, his baby finger than many of us do combined. Like, he's just sort of made for the screen and made for people's eyes to be drawn to him. Like, you're just drawn to him because he just has this thing. And you know, people will say that he's just Keanu Reeves in every role, and I don't really think that's true. I think that it's just that he brings so much of himself, and he brings so much of characters out with him into the world, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think
Daniel Day-Lewis, in a different way.
Well, Daniel Day-Lewis is kind of like an immersive actor where he's, you know, he's trying to tap into the history and the time period and making the shoes of the character and all that stuff. I think that Keanu is very adept at recognizing what parts of himself he has to accentuate in the role. You know, John Wick is not the same character as Ted Logan, but they're kind of on a spectrum, I think, and Keanu's very attuned to where this character lies on his spectrum, and that's not an easy task. That's not an easy feat. That, you know, being able to accentuate one part of yourself while downplaying the other, and he's just a wonderful talent, and I'm glad he's still working.
Me too.
Okay, and Alex...
12-year-old self agrees.
And Alex Winter is great, too. And I just want to say that, too, because I know Alex Winter has been doing a lot of doc stuff. And I've seen a couple of his docs, and they're not too shabby. So he's a very talented documentary filmmaker. And I'm glad that he was able to step so easily, or perhaps make it look so easy, he was able to step back into the role of William S. Preston Esquire. So, bravo to Alex Winter as well, because I from what I understand too, he's also kind of like a driving creative force behind getting Bill and Ted Face the Music made after all these years. And to wrap up, I will add, maybe, you know, sometimes making a sequel 3 decades later isn't such a bad thing, and maybe I've been too cynical about it the whole time, and Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, the ball is now in that court.
Okay.
Candace, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they find you on the internet?
I am everywhere on the internet at Cinn48, that's CINN48. And you can also check out the newest episode of the Village Podcast from the Bookshelf,
It's back.
Yes, it's back, finally. We accidentally took the summer off, which is fine. I think we should plan to take the summer off next time rather than accidentally doing it. But we are back, and there is a new episode out this week.
Perfect. And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, as always. And if you'd like to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. And speaking of Spotify, you can find the playlist for all the music we play on End Credits on Spotify. Just look for End Credits on CFRU and smash that add button. You can find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. I write about news and politics on guelphpolitico.ca, and you can find my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. And by all means, stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back here next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for another edition of End Credits, and we will see you next time.